Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the sudden about-face by Donald Trump, who cancelled the forthcoming summit in Singapore with Kim Jong-un in a letter to the North Korean dictator in which Trump makes childish boasts about Kim's puny nukes compared to his, writing, quote, "But ours are so massive and powerful that I pray to God they will never have to be used." Sumi Terry, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Affairs, who was previously the Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council, joins us. We will discuss how it appears Trump's new NSC advisor, John Bolton, first derailed the summit by referring to the Libyan model of nuclear disarmament, which alarmed Kim with the prospect of him ending up like Gaddafi. Then Vice President Pence went further by remarking that the Libyan model of the dictator ending up being torn apart by a mob could apply to Kim if he did not make a deal with Trump. This prompted the North Koreans to reply angrily, calling Pence a political dunce. And that caused Trump to write in his letter to Kim that, quote, "Sadly, based on the tremendous anger and open hostility displayed in your recent statement, the summit will not take place." Then we'll examine the meeting today arranged by the White House Chief of Staff in which Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, FBI Director Christopher Wray, and the DNI Dan Coats briefed Republican Congressman Devin Nunes and Trey Gowdy in response to the phony claims by President Trump, who is trying to manufacture a scandal he calls Spygate, alleging the FBI infiltrated his campaign and spied on him. Mark Lowenthal, the president of the Intelligence and Security Academy, who is Republican staff director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, joins us to discuss how wrong it was for Trump's new lawyer, Emmett Flood, to attend, and that allowing the Democrat Adam Schiff in at the last minute made it less of a partisan farce. Then finally, we will speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian John Meacham about his latest book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. We will discuss this urgent moment we are living in with America at the crossroads under a president who is at war with the truth and the law. But while it may seem we are facing unprecedented threats to American democracy itself, Meacham argues we have had presidents before who were not commensurate with the task and that we should not panic, but we also should not relax. And joining us now, Sumi Terry, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Previously was the National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sumi Terry.
Thank you for having me on.
And Sue, you must feel somewhat whipsawed trying to follow what's going on between the U.S. and North Korea. But it seems particularly disturbing that, as far as we know, the talks broke down, or the arrangements for a summit broke down, over John Bolton's statements about the Libya model being the one for the North Koreans to follow in terms of disarmament. They thought that meant ending up like Gaddafi. And then that was reinforced by Mike Pence, who suggested that if Kim were not to make a deal with Trump, he would end up with the Libyan model in terms of his fate. And that led the North Koreans to refer to the vice president as a political dummy. And that was apparently enough for Donald Trump to cancel the talks. Is that your understanding of the chain of events?
Yes. I mean, as President Trump was so spontaneous about his decision to accept a meeting with Kim Jong-un, which was done quite rashly. It was not really by anybody's advice, because we just, you know, it's a big deal for a sitting U.S. president to meet with a North Korean leader. And so this decision, I think it comes from President Trump, and he also spontaneously decided not to do it. When you look at the letter that President Trump has written to Kim Jong-un, it's very much his own words. I mean, you recognize his own words, like beautiful gesture and things like of that nature. So we'll see what happens and where to go from here. But, you know, it's, as you say, it's a whiplash. It's first, now there was going to be a summit, which was unprecedented, and now there isn't.
So what about reports, though, that Kim was nervous the fact that his plane doesn't have the range really to go anywhere further than Singapore, and he was even worried about getting to Singapore, worried about security there, even worried about being absent from Pyongyang, and in his absence there may be a coup. Is there anything to that?
I think he was skittish and nervous about his plane having enough fuel to make this round trip to Singapore. I mean, it's a genuine concern because no North Korean leader has flown that far. This is why Switzerland and Sweden, these countries, were ultimately ruled out as a potential venue because North Korea really does not have a plane that could take, you know, there's just no record. We don't even know a pilot has flown that far, a North Korean pilot. So it was a genuine concern. And I know the South Koreans were working, trying to alleviate that concern somehow, like allow him to stop somewhere where he can fuel or whatnot. But it's a real concern. Now, far as potential coup concerns, that's hard to say. The fact that Kim Jong-un accepted this meeting in the first place in Singapore with a publicly acknowledged date when he knew he was going to be away for a couple of days, that shows that he was pretty confident in his grip on power. So I think it had more to do with logistical concerns, like a plane, you know, that's able to make a round-trip flight to Singapore.
So what did you make, though, of President Trump's remarks the other day implying that he was annoyed with the Chinese, that Kim's tone and disposition towards these talks had changed after he made his second trip to Dalian in China, and President Trump was really implying that some of the Chinese are trying to screw up these talks?
Yes, I've been hearing that too, but it's hard to know because we don't really have a readout of exactly what occurred, what conversation took place between President Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un the second time they met. Chinese are, you know, they're in an interesting position. On one hand, you would think that China should welcome North Korea and U.S. sitting down together and easing tensions and no more talk of military strike and so on. And if there is a grand bargain of some sort, like a peace treaty or normalization, we might even reduce U.S. troops stationed in South Korea, which you would think the Chinese would welcome. But China is also very concerned that its own interest is not going to be protected. They don't like to be sidelined. And they are always worried about losing influence, both North Korea and South Korea, to the United States. So it's really hard to tell. It's hard to know exactly what Xi Jinping told Kim Jong-un. But sequence of events, because it's after he came back, Kim Jong-un came back from his meeting with Xi Jinping, you know, President Trump feels that something went wrong. So, I mean, I don't have hard evidence. It just is a sequence of events is suspicious.
Well, but in President Trump's photo opportunity today, where he spoke about pulling out of the talks in Singapore with him and Kim Jong-un on schedule for June the 12th, he went on at length about how powerful the U.S. military is. He talked about our military budget of $700 billion a year, how it's going to go up next year, and how he's rebuilt the military. We have the most fearsome military in the world. That struck me as not being the most appropriate way to deal with it, because one of the fears I've heard is that if these talks were to happen and go sour, then there wouldn't be much else to do except move towards a military option. And it seems like right out of the gate, he's talking about this, and does that concern you?
It does very much concern me. And even in the letter that President Trump wrote to Kim Jong-un, I don't like when he made a reference to, again, U.S.'s nuclear capability, how we have much more powerful capability. And again, in this statement that you just talked about, you know, how the $700 billion this year budget and, you know, $716 billion next year, and we have this amazing military and so on. It just feeds into Kim Jong-un's own paranoia. And already, when it is all this talk about Libya and what happened to Gaddafi, and they're concerned about security stuff, it's just this kind of rhetoric is not helpful. It's not productive. So I think we're just not really disciplined in terms of communicating the right message to North Koreans.
Well, in his letter, just that you, since you mentioned it, the Sumitary, Trump said, "You talk about your nuclear capabilities, but ours are so massive and powerful that I pray to God they will never have to be used." I mean, that's a little bit like kindergarten kids.
No, it's pretty juvenile. I wish that sentence was not in there. Otherwise, you know, you can tell that letter is very much written by Trump himself. Otherwise, you know, it's okay to sort of say, you know, I'm expressing sadness. I was really eager to meet with you. That's all fine. But yeah, that sentence that you just talked about, I think it's unfortunate.
So there was a piece at Reuters by Kent Harrington. I assume he was a former colleague of yours. He was station chief with the CIA in Northeast Asia. And he made the case that, and this was before Trump pulled out, but he made the case that he thought the entire focus on nuclear weapons was actually the wrong focus, that the real danger on the Korean Peninsula is the conventional weapons, particularly those on the part of the North, most of which the million-man army has all of these weapons trained on Seoul in hardened caves where within, you know, minutes the capital of South Korea could be absolutely ruined and this would absolutely devastate the country. Do you think he's got the right focus or that, in effect, what he's arguing is that so far we've had the wrong focus?
Well, it's not a wrong focus. It's just that I don't think it's necessarily wrong focus because what we are saying is nuclear capability to attack mainland United States. I mean, it's true. What he's talking about is that, of course, North Korea has conventional capability to wipe out South Korea and Japan. And they even have capability, nuclear capability right now in terms of South Korea and Japan threat. But if we're concerned about U.S. threat, I mean, this is where we're focusing on nuclear weapons. But I think it's overall relationship with North Korea. And it's not just a conventional versus nuclear, because they also have chemical and biological weapons, a very robust one, cyber warfare. I mean, and they, you know, so it's really about fundamentally altering our relationship with North Korea to deal with all these issues, not just nuclear versus conventional or conventional versus nuclear, you know?
Well, but what's this, your sense then of whether the South Koreans, we talked about you being whipsawed as a career special and me as a journalist being whipsawed by the White House, the South Koreans must feel really whipsawed.
Absolutely. President Moon Jae-in was just here. He thought he had a good meeting with Trump. He thought he was able to lay out a case of the summit, that he thought he was able to achieve his goal, which was to get, you know, that he left Washington thinking that Trump was going to meet with Kim Jong-un. And now, you know, I'm sure they're having an extremely panicked moment. I'm sure it's not a happy time in Seoul right now. And we didn't consult, Trump did not consult with President Moon before announcing this, you know, news. So I'm sure South Koreans are quite upset by it, and they will try to still work quite hard in the back channels, probably reaching out to the North Koreans and us, try to see if we can somehow, if they can get us to, you know, get back on the, get back to where we were in terms of having, you know, summit preparation and so on.
But Sumi Terry, is there a pattern here? Because the U.S. or Trump pulled out of the JCPOA, the P5+1 deal with Iran, and Pompeo said shortly thereafter that we can revisit the deal, Trump did too, and make a better deal. And they're more or less saying the same thing now, that we just pulled out of this summit, but we can turn around and make a better summit. That strikes me as being incredibly naive, because hasn't Kim Jong-un lost a lot of face on the world stage?
I don't know if Kim Jong-un has lost a lot of face. I think actually Kim Jong-un is in a better position today than where he was in November, December. As a result of Olympics, the diplomacy and summitry, even without summit with Trump, he has gained some respect by the world. He normalized himself. He did an image makeover. He got to meet with Moon Jae-in and Xi Jinping twice. Maybe he has weakened political will from China to continue to implement sanctions. He has completely weakened any kind of will for for military strikes. So it's not, Kim is still in a better position today than where he was a few months ago, I would say.
So do you think then that the North and the South could pick up the pieces? How far can they proceed without the U.S.?
Well, North and South can still continue to go on a little bit. I mean, there are family reunions. There are some good things that they can do on a humanitarian front. But you're right. I mean, ultimately, if the U.S. continues this fairly hardline policy towards North Korea and really try to ratchet up sanctions and maximum political pressure, South Korea will be caught in the middle, and it will be a very difficult position for Seoul to be in, trying to navigate between these, you know, Washington and Pyongyang. This is why I think President Moon is not going to give up so easily, and he's going to try very hard to see if he can get Trump and Kim to meet at some point in the future.
And you mentioned that the Chinese may be easing up on the sanctions, and it was, after all, my understanding is, was the fact that China joined the UN sanctions and really did implement them, and that did affect the North, and that many argue that that's what brought them to the negotiating table. Was there ever any evidence of triangulation on the part of Kim Jong-un? Was he trying to play the U.S. off against China? Would that explain what Trump was talking about in terms of blaming China for changing Kim's tone?
Well, yeah, we don't know what kind of assurance that Kim Jong-un got from Xi Jinping. If he said, you know, if we close the Punggye-ri nuclear site, if I don't test anymore, will you ease up on sanctions? And he got some assurance from Xi Jinping that he feels like now he can sort of come back and play a little bit more hardball with the United States. It's hard to know because there's still no readout of exactly what conversation took place. But it's true that after the first meeting between Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping, there was already, we've seen some relaxation of sanctions that China was implementing since the fall of last year. So that's something that we need to continue to monitor. And it would be also important to see how much the U.S. continues to pressure China to continue in terms of sanctions implementation.
But could Kim replace the economic lifeline he has with China as being its major trading partner and providing them with much-needed fuel and what little foreign exchange they get? Could there be a switch to the point where he could end up having closer relations with South Korea economically than with China?
Well, of course he can, but it's hard to do when United Nations Security Council resolutions are still in place. Unless that gets changed, you know, these member countries are obligated to continue on sanctions front. Now, that still doesn't mean that China will faithfully implement. There can be all kinds of UNSC resolutions. China could just choose to not implement them. It'll be a difficult case for South Korea to really open up economically, like let's say reopen the Kaesong Industrial Complex, because there will be in violation of United Nations Security Council resolution. It's not so easy to do, but again, political will in terms of implementing sanctions have been weakened.
Well, just at the end of the day, though, do you think the fact that these talks have been postponed and it doesn't seem likely that they will be resumed anytime soon? I was always puzzled as to why Kim agreed in the first place, particularly if at the end of the day it would mean him opening up his country more to the world. And that would, by definition, chip away at this sort of cocoon of delusion that the North Koreans have from cradle to grave. They're told that they are the center of the world and what a great deal they have. And if they were to learn that they don't have a very good deal, that the people in the South who are supposed to be starving actually have a robust economy and high standard of living, I never understood why he was willing to take that risk. Now it would seem he doesn't have to. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, you know what? The South Koreans kept saying, you know, Kim Jong-un is fundamentally different from his father, Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung, in that he's a very young leader. So he would have to rule next 30 to 40 years, and he doesn't want to rule a pariah, backward, poor state anymore, that he does care about how internationally he's perceived, that he does want to bring economic development to North Korea, and so on. But as you point out, if that is true, and it does show that there are some indications that Kim Jong-un wants to be a modern leader of modern North Korea. That's why when he came into power, one of the first things he did was build all these modern trappings of what he think would, you know, of a modern state, whether it's an amusement park or a ski resort or aquarium and so on. But even if that's true, as you point out, as he opens up, as he moves down this path, then it's going to be all kinds of issues. There's all kinds of hurdles that he would have to cross. Like, do you open the North up, for information to come into North Korea? Because that's what's required if you're going to truly open up your country for investment and everything else. And so far, North Korea has been living off, you know, the way the regime was able to continue was by having a monopoly on information and ideological indoctrination and making sure that outside information come into North Korea and so on. So that would always have been a challenge. So I think, you know, for now, maybe Kim got cold feet. We'll see. This summit is not going to happen, at least for the foreseeable future. And, you know, he will go back to, you know, doing what he was doing before.
Well, just in closing, though, I detect a certain amount of amateurism in this whole thing. And we know that President Trump is not your normal politician. He's not a politician at all. But I spoke recently about Bolton's remarks on the Libyan model, which the North Koreans reacted very strongly to, and said that they see him, I think the word they used was with repugnance. But I asked this specialist on the neoconservatives, wrote a book about the neoconservatives, about their influence over this administration. I said, is John Bolton off the reservation? And his response was, there is no reservation. So is it really that way at the White House that other people, because we have a vacuum at the top, people like Bolton and people like Vice President Pence can manipulate things to the point where the entire landscape changes and the president is a sort of passive observer in his own statecraft?
Well, I think it's kind of, you know, I mean, there's also people like Pompeo that Trump listens to. So, and I think he's been pretty reasonable, and he wanted engagement with North Korea. He's someone who went to North Korea, met with Kim Jong-un twice. So there is sort of, you know, multiple figures in his administration, and not everybody sees it exactly the same way. And, you know, it's not entirely for to blame the Trump, blame President Trump. I mean, North Korea did come up with these statements, even though it's a response to the Libya comment. But, you know, I always was wondering if North Korea was truly intentionally, you know, wanted to give up nuclear weapons program in the first place. So I don't think they've ever said that. They're intending to unilaterally disarm, basically. So it just basically what's happening is that these very different expectations we had very different definition of denuclearization. It's now coming to a head with a couple weeks ago, and that's why it got canceled, ultimately, because we couldn't bridge this gap.
Well, Sumi Terry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure.
And again, I've been speaking with Sumi Terry, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Previously was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the meeting today with Republican congressmen who, along with Donald Trump, are trying to manufacture a scandal Trump calls Spygate.